The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer. List of today's guests. Signing in chat room. Lining up news articles.
Checking level.
Adjusting camera.
Secure wire connection.
Restart computer. Checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Oh, I'm here. I am here. Welcome to a Monday, everybody. Yeah, it's a Monday. It feels like a Monday, doesn't it? Except we had a good weekend. Well, not necessarily us, but the country as a whole. So the Senate reconvened on Saturday. And they were in session for around 30 hours or so. And they did what is known as the Votorama. And the Senate passed what they're calling the IRA. It's easier to remember than the Inflation Reduction Act. I keep wanting to say infrastructure, probably because we've been infrastructured, you know, into oblivion over the last so many years. But no, the Inflation Reduction Act. And whether it does anything about inflation or not, it does have some really good points on three fronts. It deals with healthcare, it deals with climate change, and it deals with taxation. And although, you know, as we feared, Kyrsten Sinema, affectionately known as Miss Sinema, she objected to the bill's action in doing away with something called the carried interest loophole. This would have brought $14 billion in revenue to pay for the $740 billion bill. So in terms of the size of the whole thing, it was a drop in the bucket, but it was important because Joe Manchin demanded everything be paid for. Well, you know, Kyrsten Sinema had to look out for her big money benefactors. But in this case, she came up with a suitable replacement. Now, yes, they still need to get rid of that carried interest loophole, because it's a loophole and it allows these people who are hoarding a lot of money not to pay taxes on them, and that needs to be fixed. But what this did was, let me get the verbiage correct, because I don't want to I don't want to give you bad information. So what they did, what she did was, tax reform. She agreed to sign on to the bill if the provision that killed the carried interest tax loophole was deleted from it. And they took it out. But in its place, a 1% excise tax on stock buybacks. Do you remember when so many of these giant corporations took all of the PPP funding? That's what it was called, right? That's how quickly we forget. All of the pandemic emergency funding so that these companies could stay staffed up and continue paying their employees. Well, a lot of them used that money to buy back stocks, as they did with their big windfall from the Trump tax giveaway to the wealthiest Americans. They used it to buy back stocks, not to give their employees, you know, raises, not to make their lives easier or better, to buy back the stock. So in this case, this was a good trade-off. A 1% excise tax on stock buybacks was introduced, and it could bring in roughly five times as much revenue as the carried interest measure. Now, you know there's a downside, right? The downside is that it doesn't go into effect until next year. So this puts them all on notice that come 2023, you will pay this 1% excise tax on stock buybacks. I guarantee you that in calendar year 2022, they will spend as much as possible buying back this stock because they won't have to pay that tax on it yet. But that's how Washington works, or more accurately, doesn't work. So a little later on, I bring you what's news. At the end of the hour, we go into a little more detail on what's in the bill. And we'll get to that. And coming up today on the show, I told you last week we would have Will Bunch today. Will Bunch, old friend of the program. He's been on many, many times. And he's got a new book out. It's called After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. That's the important part. Actually, Will and I taped the interview a couple of hours ago because, you know, we're friends. So he booked me and the publisher booked other interviews. And so go figure, he got double booked for this afternoon. And I said, that's all right. We can tape it if you want. So we taped it at 1:00. I didn't edit anything. It's going to air just as we had the conversation. So it's live on tape. Got it? All right. So that's coming up. But I got to tell you, not this past week, because I took Friday off. The week before, last Friday, I had on the show an old friend. And so I need to give you the postscript, the PS on, you know, my conversation with John Ondrasik. So for those of you who weren't listening, John Ondrasik is the band Five for Fighting. I've known him for 30 years. I was a big supporter of his before he became famous. I'm the first person to ever play him on the radio in both Los Angeles and Boston. I played, you know, I helped break him as an artist. He acknowledges it, and it's all well and good. It's all fine. We were friends. I destroyed our friendship some years ago because, well, the bottom line is we differ politically. He is a Republican. I learned that back in, you know, around the 2000 elections. We just never really talked politics is all. And then I moved away from California. So, you know, we lost touch. But when Andrew Breitbart died a few years ago, John had tweeted something. Oh, he lost a good man. You know, and I responded to him in a cold and uncaring kind of way saying, Breitbart? He was only ever an asshole to me. And then after I sent it, I felt bad because I thought, you know what? It's his friend. His friend died. It was unnecessary and uncalled for. And I did apologize to him, but our friendship went off the rails anyway. Well, fast forward another 10 years. And, so, you know, we sort of, reformed our friendship, though never as close as it was before. He is a Republican. And I purposely didn't bring that up before he came on the show to talk about the song that he wrote to benefit the people of Ukraine and the video that he filmed over there, which was pretty amazing. I thought I would tell you about it afterwards, which I did. But I've also told you for the longest time something that I told John in an email. And I just want to finish the story so you know sort of how it ended. What I said to him as we were going back and forth in emails trying to get the whole thing set up, and then I had the copyright problem when the video aired. In an email I sent to him, I wrote this question. I said, one of these days, you and I need to have a conversation, a civilized conversation about politics. And the date on this was August 8th. And I said, what's your take on the Senate Republicans blocking the veterans' fire pit health care bill and then celebrating that they did? Is there a reason other than the vindictiveness because the Democrats finally got one over on them? And then, so I had resent him that question that I originally asked him on July 29th. And then I wrote this on the bottom. I said, I always say I'd love to have a good conversation with a reasonable Republican to try to understand what they're thinking, but no Republicans I know are willing to stipulate to basic facts like grass is green and sky is blue and Biden won the 2020 election. Would you be willing to talk to me about things we fundamentally disagree about? We could do it as an example of how adults can communicate even when they disagree. Sorry, that's today. So I sent that today, resending the question that I originally asked him on July 29th. And he wrote back. He said, the reason was because the Democrats inserted billions of dollars that was not related to the burn pit issue. I spoke to senators on both sides of the Hill about this, glad to see it passed, smiley emoji. And the thing is, that's wrong. And I wrote back, actually, they didn't. Meaning they didn't insert anything not related. I said nothing in the bill changed. They just didn't like that the Democrats got one over on them. So I'm guessing that's a no. You don't want to have that conversation. And he responded with this quote, John Stewart effect. And he misspelled John. He put an H in his name. Just pet peeve. Anyway, John Stewart effect, he writes. And then he said, the answer is no. I'm so consumed by politics daily with my interviews and podcasts. I take relief in my friends' conversations that are non-political. Okay, you know what that is, right?
Bullshit.
That's just bullshit. And so I responded to him again. And I wrote back, John Stewart, spelled J-O-N, and he told the truth while your friends at Fox continued to lie about it. Not a dollar was added before they voted against it, and nothing was changed when they voted for it. And then I said, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry you're so consumed by lies and anger that you, too, refused to stipulate to the facts. And he didn't respond. The other two, he responded to me immediately. So I went and I found an article from the Washington Post. And again, I wrote nothing changed from the Washington Post. And I quoted, on an 86-11 roll call, the vote served as a political surrender by Senate Republicans a week after they blocked consideration of the popular legislation, seemingly out of political pique. P-I-Q-U-E, because Democrats announced a party line deal on an unrelated massive domestic policy bill that could not be that could be considered later this week. Republicans tried for several days to contend that last week's blockage of the PACT Act had to do with a technical argument about which portion of the federal budget would fund $280 billion worth of new allocation for veterans' health programs. But 25 Republicans who had recently supported the exact same bill switched their votes last Wednesday, less than an hour after Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Joe Manchin announced their deal on the ambitious legislation unrelated to the PACT Act. So I copied that passage and included it, and then I wrote, maybe get your news from a more credible source than Fox. They lie to you all the time. And so I sent that. Oh, when did I send that? I sent that about 45 minutes ago and have still gotten no response. And I will get no response. So that's my, I guess, again, former friend, John Ondrasik. And it's sad because I tried to have a dialogue with a Republican friend of mine. And he just regurgitated Republican Fox lies. And when I tried to present him with the facts, he ignored me. It's sad. No one can say I didn't try. I tried. You know what? While I tried, let me show you who Republicans are fighting for. Fighting to go to the Senate. So in Georgia, we've got a sitting senator who's beyond reproach in Raphael Warnock. But this ad was just released today about his opponent, Herschel Walker. Herschel Walker's ex-wife wanted you to know who he really is.
Do you think you know Herschel Walker? Touchdown, Georgia. Well, think again. Listen to what his ex-wife had to say about him.
Uh-oh. His eyes would become very evil. The guns and knives. I got into a few choking things with him.
Oy.
The first time he held the gun to my head, he held the gun to my temple and said he was going to blow my brains out.
Oh, nice. Republican voters against Walker. That's who paid for that ad. Again, it is opposite world. Those two don't inhabit the same universe, and there's no way they should be virtually tied in the polls. Republicans don't care who they hurt as long as they have power, and that's frightening. So let's stop it, okay? All right, well, let's have that conversation about college loan debt, shall we? Yeah, so my friend Will Bunch was on the show today, and as they say in the movies, Let's go to the videotape. Here we go.
Well, it's always my pleasure to host Will Bunch on the show, but it's even a great
pleasure. Oh, I know. I know. Hold on. I'll get rid of the echo in a second.
Will Bunch is the national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
No, it's coming. Hold on.
We get his newsletter, but every once in a while, Will puts out a book, as is the case now. In fact, this book
will be
out
tomorrow. It's
called After the Ivory Tower.
Hold on 1 second. I got to get rid of the echo. Echo, 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 echo. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. I'm going to get rid of the echo because this is going to really bug me. Give me 1 second. We're going to bring it in again, minus the echo. Okay, you ready? Let's try this. Take two.
After you and I first touched base a couple months ago, and the book came out last week, so you can get it. You can go on right now and download it from Audible to your phone if you want to listen to it, or download it to your Kindle. It's available now.
Oh, there you go. And it's still echoing, and I don't know why. So in that case, we got to do it differently. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to make you listen to that echo, echo, echo all along. Now I just got to find where I put the interview again and bring it in a different way. It's always something. If it's not one thing, it's another, as they say. Hold on. All right. Well, take two with Will Bunch. Give me one moment here so I can line up the thing again. I'm sorry about this. It wasn't supposed to happen that way. All right. Take two. Here we go. Will Bunch.
As is the case now. In fact, this book will officially be out tomorrow. It's called After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Will Bunch, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to tell your listeners real quickly, we made a change after you and I first touched base a couple months ago, and the book came out last week.
Oh.
So you can get it. You can go on right now and download it from Audible to your phone if you want to listen to it, or download it to your Kindle. It's available now.
Oh, there you go.
Get it sent overnight. It's out there, or it's hopefully it's at your local bookstore, especially independent bookshops, which really need our support these days. So.
Most definitely. And you know what? If you want to buy it online, there's a great, and I have no stake in this, but bookshop.org. That's who I link to these days. I don't link to the other one. So I'll put a link on the blog with today's show to the bookshop.org place to buy this. But at local booksellers or Audible, all those are a good way. And so congratulations. What number book is this for you?
It's the fourth book I've done for a major publisher. I did one a long time ago about jukeboxes. That's number four, but in the last 12 years, I've done three that have been more politically oriented. So I did, Tear Down This Myth about Ronald Reagan and his legacy. And, then, The Backlash was kind of a look at the Tea Party in real time.
Right.
And now this book, where I try and look at how college became the big fault line in American politics.
You also did a Bernie book, though. That was not with a major publisher.
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually did. In the 2010s, I was hooked up with, speaking of Amazon, I was, for better or worse, I was hooked up with them in their Amazon Kindle single series.
Oh, right.
So these books were only available on Kindle, which, Kindle never caught on the way they really thought it would. There are millions of people who do read Kindle, but it never became the dominant reading force that people thought it might be like 12 years ago. In fact, I think that program has been discontinued.
Oh,
but,
really?
Yeah. I wrote about Bernie Sanders, and I wrote a book about Occupy. An ebook about Occupy Wall Street, and even one, because I just wanted it to do something really different, one about pro football. So there you go. So
interesting. I didn't know about the
fun.
Football
but,
one.
But this book is the fourth book that's come out in hardcover. So
okay, and this book it's an important topic, and even more so today. In fact, Democrats, everybody should be celebrating the passage in the Senate of this, what they're calling the infrastructure what, Infrastructure Reduction Act or something, the IRA, right? Yeah. It's easier to remember IRA than the Infrastructure Inflation Reduction Act. I'm stuck on infrastructure. Right. But the IRA, because as Bernie says, yeah, maybe it'll bring down the inflation a little bit, but it does some good things. However, it leaves out tons of stuff that, you know, this time a year or two ago, we thought were possibilities. Right. One of them being forgiving student loan debt. And that just is nowhere on the table anymore. Now, can you put that all off on Joe Manchin, or is this a Joe Biden problem?
Well, I think most people who are really into this issue feel it's mainly a Joe Biden problem. The issue here is, does the president, as head of the administration, does he have the authority to cancel federal student loans, to eliminate them? And most experts believe he probably does. I mean, certainly, as we've seen the last 2 years, he's had the presidential authority to postpone any payments on these loans during the pandemic. I mean, there's been a 2-year freeze on loan payments, which has been a huge boon to our young people in particular. And supposedly, when Biden took office, he requested a memo making clear that he does have this authority, and it's believed that the memo said he does, but they kept the memo a secret, which is interesting. This is something that Joe Manchin supposedly can't block. I mean, that's what a lot of, in terms of the politics, a lot of people have been saying for months, hey, President Biden, you really need to shore up your support with young voters. You made this promise during the 2020 campaign that you would eliminate at least $10,000 per individual of student debt.
And $10,000 was nowhere near what others were calling for. Some were saying wipe it all out. Some said $50,000. Joe Biden, being very conservative in the actual definition of the term, said, no, we'll do it at 10, but he still hasn't done anything.
At least, he left the door open for it could be higher. And, Elizabeth Warren has been a really strong voice on this. In fact, I interviewed her a couple months ago specifically about student loans. And, she makes a strong argument for $50,000, that she feels that would eliminate most debt for most people. And the one thing that people say, well, what about these people who go to medical school or law school, and they do have to take out $100,000, but, as doctors and lawyers, they're going to have the wherewithal to pay it back. And she says, all right, the $50,000 means that those people still have to, make some repayment. So that's her argument, that she wouldn't do a total elimination. Now, I mean, activist groups that are out there, like the Debt Collective, which is staged some of these protests, you might have seen pictures of, or seen video of on Twitter. They're calling for complete and total debt elimination. It's been surprising there's no action on that. When you were talking about legislation on Capitol Hill, I actually thought you were going to mention another Biden promise, which people have almost totally forgotten about by now, which is that he promised to push for free community college.
Yes.
And that was something that Joe Manchin did block, that was originally supposed to be part of the Build Back Better plan, and it dropped. I wrote a column that it was actually the very first thing that was forced out of the Build Back Better plan. And I mean, to me, it kind of showed just a general attitude of disrespect towards young voters, because I felt like, and things have changed now, but this is what it looked like 8 or 9 months ago, the big issues for young voters were student debt and climate change, which at that time, nothing seemed to be happening.
Right.
And also, free community college, reducing the cost of college. And these seemed to be the things that were falling by the wayside fastest.
Right.
Now, like I said, it's looking a little bit better now. We've seen significant action with this bill on climate change, which I think will help young voters. The Democrats really have a chance to turn this around. The Dobbs decision and the way that's energized young voters and female voters and what we saw in Kansas last week. you know, suggests a way forward politically. I mean, it's a terrible thing that happened, but politically going forward, it does suggest a path for the Democrats. But they can really build on this with, you know, again, climate change. I think that will get young voters more interested again, because, yeah, Biden's approval among young voters had really dropped to a ridiculously low level just a couple months ago.
Oh, horribly, horribly. Yeah.
And so now, so the student loan repayments are supposed to resume on September 1st.
Oy.
So we know there's going to be something, some decision of some kind is going to be made.
Before then.
In the next 3 weeks, basically.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, will he do yet another extension and pump the football down the road a little bit further? Or, you know, will he do this $10,000? You know, I mean,
which he can do by executive action, right?
Yeah. I mean, clearly, by executive action. I mean, clearly, $10,000 would be better than nothing. I think somewhere at least a third or more, or a little bit more than a third of borrowers have $10,000 or less. So they would be totally in the clear if this happened.
Okay. Well, it seemed.
On the other hand, you know, and in doing this book, you know, I interviewed, you know, a number of people who have college debt that's in the six figures. You know, the one young person I profile in depth, between he and his mother, who took out these Parent PLUS loans, the two of them have $180,000 in debt.
Oh my!
To go to Temple University in Philadelphia, which is, I mean, I love Temple. I think it's a great university. I taught there as an adjunct for a couple semesters. But you know, it's not. You know, Harvard, or it's not Kenyon, which I profile in the book, which costs $76,000 a year, you know. It just shows how these loans can just add up. You know, the New Yorker had this amazing profile last week of this 91-year-old woman who, I forget, it was like, who had like $80,000 or $90,000 in debt at age 91.
Oh, my. You
know? She'd gone back to school, like in her 50s, to get a degree, and the balances go up instead of going down.
Yeah.
And $10,000 isn't going to do a lot for these people.
No.
So, yeah.
You know, what's really upsetting is the way things have changed over the years. So Will Bunch, you and I, we've had these discussions many times. We are the same age. So I went to look up what it cost to go. I went to University of South Florida here, in-state tuition at a state university in Florida. And let me pull this up because it is stunning. Well, here, I can put it up on the screen because I found this chart. So I don't know if you can read it because the print's going to be kind of small, but it shows back. Now, I graduated high school. I started college in 77 to 78. This chart begins 78, 79, but you can see tuition, and this is for a full semester, was something like $516.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah, that was typical for a public university.
Right. And now it's about $6,500 for the same in-state tuition here in Florida. This doesn't account for out-of-state tuition. It has more than tenfold. And it's gotten worse. If you look at private institutions, it's even worse than that. And so in the book, after the Ivory Tower falls, Will Bunch, you go back and you trace what happened with college education. And you go back really to the GI Bill, to World War II, right?
Yeah. From World War II, you know, until about the 1970s, until about that time that you and I became students, was kind of the golden age of college in America. And it started with the GI Bill, which was a little bit of a fluke. It just targeted one slice of the U.S. population, which was returning war veterans who obviously were men, and the program was designed in a way it's complicated. But of course, black soldiers didn't benefit as much as from the program as white soldiers did. But that's a complicated story. But but you have to understand that only 5% of American adults had a bachelor's degree in the 1940s.
Wow.
Just just by comparison, the number today is 37%. So you're talking about a huge difference in the number of people who were able to complete 4 years of college between then and now. And it was kind of thought that most middle-class people maybe weren't called, you know, people went to high school, maybe they graduated, maybe they didn't, but then they went to work in a factory or went to work in a farm or some other type of blue-collar job for the most part. And it was kind of thought that middle-class folks weren't college material, that maybe they couldn't cut it. There was a lot of snobbery from administrators, like the president of the University of Chicago lobbied against the GI Bill because he said it would turn our campuses into, quote, hobo jungles, unquote, that these, you know, unqualified, you know, veterans would just show up to get the stipend and the money for attending school and ruin the campus. And instead, the opposite happened. They, you know, a couple of years later, these same administrators came back and said, we were wrong. These were the best students we ever had. You know, that they have this real hunger to learn and to better themselves and to maybe stake out a career where they're using their mind instead of using their hands. And it really, you know, like I said, it really started this virtuous cycle where right after the GI Bill, which because it was so heavily utilized, you know, colleges had to expand and build new dorms and whatnot. And this flowed right into the coming of the baby boom. So, you know, and the prosperity of the 1950s and the early 1960s, where you had this growing middle class with lots of babies, and they wanted to send those babies off to college.
Right. And, so you're right.
Like you said, it was affordable. I mean, you know, ever since the GI Bill opened up college as a possibility for Americans, there have been two basic questions, right? Which is, well, what is college for, and who's going to pay for it? And you know, during this time, it looked like college was on its way to becoming a public good, like K-12 education.
You know? Right. Your chapter two, when college in America almost became a public good.
Right. And we didn't quite get there. I mean, we came close. I mean, there was a lot of taxpayer support and government support for the idea of higher education, which is how tuition at schools like South Florida were able to stay so low, which is how the University of California, which, you know, was this outstanding public university system, was tuition free up until the mid 1970s.
Right.
You know, CUNY, the City University of New York, which was a pathway for so many of these kids, you know, from Brooklyn and, you know, Queens, the kids of immigrants who worked their way up into the professional class. And, again, free. It was totally free, CUNY. It didn't last.
Right. You know, you look back on
by the 1970s, there was a conservative backlash against the idea of low-cost public higher education. And as you can guess, a lot of this was inspired by the campus unrest of the 1960s.
Well, that leads to your next chapter. Why the Kent State Massacre raised your tuition. That's an interesting way to put it. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but this had to do with student activism, with kids rising up and saying not so fast, and maybe with the rise of the Vietnam War.
Yeah. Well, that second question that I posed, which is, the first question I posed, which is, what is college for? If you go back to that period, there was a lot of conversation among the thought leaders in education about what we call liberal education, or sometimes it's called general education. But basically, it's the idea that you're going to college to become a better, more well-rounded person who's a critical thinker, who is knowledgeable about a lot of different subjects, who is ready to become more engaged as a citizen and take part in civic affairs by getting this well-rounded education. You know, in other words, the idea that you're just going to college to learn a very narrow career path and that's it. That was less, you know, I mean, obviously people hope the college would lead to a career, but that there was really an emphasis on liberal education. And you saw this in what people studied, you know, majors like English literature and theology and philosophy exploded during those years. The economy was good and people felt that they could major in philosophy and still get a good job on the other end. And they wanted to learn.
You know, and the bottom line is, Will, that many people go on to careers that have nothing to do with what they studied in college. When I tell people, you know, when I had a big career in radio, that I studied broadcasting in college, I was the exception rather than the rule. I actually went into the field that I studied. Then again, you don't really need a college education to do radio, although radio has changed so much since then, but just in general terms. But I always looked at college also as that bridge between childhood and adulthood. It gives you time to grow up. You're living on your own, but not really. You're under supervision, but not really. You know, it's that buffer.
But this was a new phenomenon culturally, right? Because up until World War II, you know, you left school somewhere between 16 and 18.
And you went to work.
And you maybe were married and having a family by the time you were 20 or in your early 20s. And now all of a sudden you had this extended adolescence. And I think that was a factor, too. So you had this generation now that they had more time on their hands because their life as a student was extended by 4 years. And they were drinking in these liberal light. When I say liberal light, I don't mean that necessarily in the Democratic Party way, but this liberal education. And the thing is that the educators who promoted this was like, well, this will help us prevent, you know, fascism like we saw in Europe, or this will help prevent communism, and this will help stave off World War III, which everybody was worried about back then.
Can you imagine if they could just transport to today for a moment and see where we are on all those fronts?
What they didn't anticipate was that this critical thinking would be directed towards the hypocrisy that was taking place in our own country. And it really started with, you know, racial segregation and racial apartheid in the Deep South. The Greensboro lunch counter sit-ins in 1960 just electrified college students, black and white, about the possibility of social change. And, within a few years, this flowed into other protest movements. People who were leaders in the civil rights protests became leaders in the Berkeley Free Speech Movement in 1964. Mm-hmm. The idea that students were adults, you know, that they were able to express political views on campus, that they weren't being babysat by the university for 4 years. And this flowed right into the Vietnam War, which was really the biggest flashpoint, you know, of the decade. And with these protests came a backlash. In 1966, you know, Ronald Reagan, who was this actor running this long shot underdog conservative campaign to become governor of California, seized on the student protests at Berkeley, the free speech movement, and some of these other protests, ran against these hippies who, you know, had long hair and, you know, we claimed smelled bad and were doing these unspeakable acts in public under flashing psychedelic lights. And it's kind of like Reefer Madness type stuff.
Right.
And read some of his campaign speeches, but it worked. You know, he won in a landslide by 1 million votes.
And is he the one who ultimately undid the free public college system in California?
It was one of his top campaign promises and one of the top things on his agenda.
Wow.
However, college is the American dream, you know, and support for cheap college was still deeply embedded. He was still kind of swimming against the tide. So he did sharply increase, you know, other fees and which was kind of backdoor tuition. But actually, tuition didn't arrive at University of California until right when he was leaving office, right after he left office, which is interesting. But he clearly laid a marker down for this new philosophy. He said at a 1967 press conference that taxpayers shouldn't be funding the intellectual curiosity of students.
Oh my God.
I mean, that's basically
That's exactly what they should be doing. Sorry, but you know, this is just one of the ways I fundamentally disagreed with everything that Ronald Reagan stood for. So, Will Bunch, let me ask you this. So you tell the story of the history of higher education in this country and what happened and how it was, you know, affordable or cheap or free. Secondary education was then done away with in this country. And now it's to the point where people are in debt for the rest of their lives for simply getting a higher education. So when we first spoke, you told me the book was coming out and I said, oh, great, you got to come on the show. I mentioned to you something that my daughter, who is now 23, was not a good student in high school, did not, you know, I don't know if you know, and it really doesn't matter to the story, but it does in that I adopted her when she was a toddler from an orphanage in Kazakhstan. So she spent her first 18 months in an orphanage and had some issues due to it. I don't know if her ADHD and other things are because of that, but possibly. But either way, there are many kids born and raised here in the U.S. that have the same issues. She did not like school. She's a smart person, just didn't like school, doesn't like the structure. And so she's graduating. And my thought is, of course you're going to college. And her thought is, why? I couldn't afford to put her through school the way my parents paid for my college. Right. Then again, it was a lot cheaper then, but still. And I certainly didn't want her going into debt for the rest of her life just to go to college when she didn't have a course of education she wanted to follow. There wasn't a certain, she didn't want to be a doctor or a lawyer just to have a liberal arts education. And we made the decision that she would not. Now, that's inconceivable. From when I was a kid, there was never any thought that we wouldn't go to college. But I think now it's a lot more common just because of the economics of it. Do you have any statistics on that?
It is more common. In fact, you know, we're starting to see the numbers come in. In the last 2 years since the pandemic, college enrollments dropped by about 9%.
Wow.
And, you know, and obviously initially the pandemic played a role in that, but people expected by now when, you know, whether or not the pandemic's over, people are acting as if the pandemic is over. So,
yeah, the pandemic's not over, but that's besides the point.
Yeah, right. But you would expect like this fall enrollment would be coming back.
Right.
And it's not. And I think it's largely for this reason, because more and more people are questioning the cost and whether it's worth it. You know, I think, you know, I mean, the main arguments I make in the book beyond that we just, you know, need to turn the battleship around once again and go back to the public good mindset and get away from the privatized mindset. But, you know, if we can adopt the public good mindset, the next step is how do we make it universal, right? How do we make sure that every young person in this country gets an opportunity, because not everybody is going to be sitting in a college classroom for 4 years. I mean, your daughter is a fantastic example of that. You know, just somebody who, you know, is just, you know, doesn't have the aptitude.
Right. And she could be helped by it. College education could be very good for her, both in terms of, you know, the bridge between childhood and adulthood, in terms of learning the social graces you learn in that situation. Yeah. Forget about the academics of it. But not to forget about them entirely. There's that whole other element that I regret she's missed out on. Then, of course, there are the academics. And if there was free community college, I believe she'd be taking classes.
Yeah, I mean, well, there'd be nothing. Yeah, you know, what would be the downside of doing
right.
that? So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think public 4-year university should be free. But,
so do I.
You know, that's going to be that's going to be a hard issue to pull off. But the fact that community college isn't free, I mean. In the book, I have a long riff about the one time the federal government really took a deep look at what federal policy should be towards higher education, and was on the brink of doing more than it ended up doing was under Harry Truman, like, again, right after the GI Bill, right after World War II, when people were excited about the possibilities for higher education. He formed this commission called the Truman Commission, and they recommended in 1947 that community college should be free for all Americans. And here we are 70 years later still talking about it. I mean, you know, we accept it as a given that K-12 education is something that we, you know, we pay for with property taxes, right, whatever. You know, even if we have no children, even if our children, you know, grew up and have left the house 10 years ago, we're still paying for the schools in our community.
Right. Now let me ask you this, and I don't know if you address this in the book because I'm not through it yet, but the highest paid public employee in many states is at a university, and it's not the chancellor or the president, it's the football coach. Now, does that have any effect, the obscene amounts of money that some of these schools pour into their football program? Does that take away from the academics? Are they spending too much money on football?
I think it does. I think the money is part of it, but I don't think the money is the biggest part of it. I think it's just more the question of priorities. You know, one sociologist or observer who wrote a book about college a couple of years ago. I think it's the title of the book, or he uses the phrase "beer and circuses." That in order to attract certain kinds of students, colleges are putting on a show, and football is like the biggest part of that, right? So many young people are attracted by what they hear about the party scene in a certain school, or about the football program, or about the other benefits that aren't the academic benefits. You know, in the early 60s, a typical college student studied 40 hours a week. By the 2000s, it was down to 24 hours. And I don't know what it is now, but I'm sure it's less than 24. And so you've seen this emphasis. And part of this is the money. You know, So what happened in a lot of these public universities, especially these, you know, flagship state universities like Arizona State, or, some of these big state schools, they can only get away with charging in-state students so much without a revolt against their political leaders. Mm-hmm. So, but they can charge out-of-state students or international students as much as they want. So, you know, the whole beer and circus scene, a big part of that is attracting these wealthy out-of-state kids.
Right. But along those lines, what happened is they put limits on how many in-state students could go. When I graduated from high school, I could pick my choice, any of the Florida state schools. As long as I graduated from a Florida high school, I could walk onto any campus I wanted to go to. Now, a Florida high school graduate with a 4.2, which was unheard of when I was a kid. They didn't go far higher than 4.0. 4.2 still can't get into the University of Florida because they're charging out-of-state students exorbitant tuitions. There's a limit to how much they can charge in-state. And so they've limited the number of in-state students they'll take. Kids who graduate from Florida schools with perfect GPA still can't get accepted to Florida state universities, which is ridiculous.
And this is true just about every state. You know, as somebody who moved to Pennsylvania in the middle of my life, it shocks me how many kids can't get into Penn State, for the same reason.
Right.
I just assume, hey, it's the big state university,
You can always go there. No, you can't.
You can always go there. In fact, I don't know what their acceptance rate is. The acceptance rate at Berkeley, public university, the University of California, a couple of years ago was 18%.
Wow.
I mean, that's just, which was like what the Ivy League acceptance rates were when I was going to apply to schools in the 70s.
So the subtitle of your book, Will Bunch, is How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Can it be fixed at this point?
Yeah. So, well, I mentioned earlier, if we change the mindset to how do we make it a public good, and there are people out there, our favorite politicians, Nicole, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, of course, have been leaders in, how do we tap into the vast inequity in American society and use some of that inequity to to make this a more equal system. You know, Elizabeth Warren is during her presidential campaign in 2020 proposed a wealth tax, and the money from that wealth tax would be the source of, you know, free public university education. I mean, we can, you know, if we're able to display a boldness that, you know, we know from the last couple of years of real life with the Biden administration, that is very hard to find on Capitol Hill. But, if we could change our priorities and not write the Pentagon a blank check every year, for example, we could put more public money into higher education, so less of a burden is put on families. But in the book, I talk about some other things that can or should be done. One of them is, it's kind of an outside the box thing, but I was going to mention this a minute ago when you were talking about your daughter, because I think it really speaks to situations like hers, is if the government really funded and promoted kind of a universal gap year for 18, mm-hmm. so that, you know, instead of the assumption that at 18, you're either racing off to college and you're making these, you know, these huge decisions on like how much money you're going to borrow or, you know, what you're going to major in. I mean, these young people feel like, and their families feel like they're deciding their whole lives at age 18, which is ridiculous. I mean, a gap year,
yes,
is a chance to take a deep breath, you know, spend a year working on something and thinking about what you really want to do with your life, you know, and how you want to proceed, whether it's college or not college, you know. And another problem that I devote a lot to in the book, and maybe this is surprising to some people, but you can't really dissect the college problem without talking a lot about the other half, which is the people who don't go to college and what mm-hmm. happens to them. I mean, first of all, you know, as the system became more unaffordable and more inaccessible, you know, people, even at a time where employers were saying you really need a college diploma to stay in a job that will give you a middle class lifestyle, you know, this has caused, you know, great anxiety and despair in these communities, you know, in blue collar yeah. communities where people's families traditionally, they were able to get a good job without going to college, and now that possibility doesn't exist. And we have so many people turning 18 who are just going off the grid, you know. I mean this is a very tiny sliver, obviously, of the population, but I don't think it's an accident or a surprise that the spate of mass shootings that we've had this year, all of them have been young men in the 18 to 22 year old bracket.
No.
who weren't going, for the most part, I think one of them was sort of going to college, but for the most part, we're not going to college and they're falling off the grid. I do a whole section in the book about this concept of deaths of despair among the working class, which is a phrase that was coined by these two Princeton economists, you know, who noticed that deaths from causes like suicide and opioid drug overdoses and alcohol addiction were really spiking among the working class, especially the white working class, which felt like it was losing the most opportunities.
Right, but you also tell the story of kids, young adults, they're not kids anymore, young adults saddled with this college debt who have also committed suicide. What? Because
you can't win, right?
It's like
you need this piece of paper to get anywhere in life. And so your two choices are, you know, don't take the risk, don't go to college, which is probably going to consign you to a lower level career. You know, I think people without college diplomas make $1 million less on average over the course of their lifetime than people who do have 4-year degrees. So there's that, but there's also the lack of respect, you know, we consider ourselves a meritocracy, which is kind of a ridiculous concept, but it's something that's ingrained in a lot of people that, you know, that if you get a college degree and if you do well, then you must have a lot of merit and you worked hard. And so the flip side of that is if you're somebody who wasn't able to get a college degree, and so many people aren't because of the cost or because of the access, they're being sent a message that they lack merit, that they,
right,
you know, it's a meritocracy.
Which is not true necessarily. No, at all.
It's not true, but if you claim that your society is a meritocracy and that the badge or the token of that meritocracy is a diploma, then you are telling people, you're telling people who don't have a diploma that they're somehow worthless. And you know what that causes? That causes resentment.
Yeah.
And right now this country is dominated by resentment politics or grievance politics, or call it what you want. But you know, I mean, there's a reason that a arena full of 15,000 people cheers when Donald Trump says, "I love the poorly educated."
You yes.
know, people who you know, consider themselves being called deplorables is a badge of honor, because you know it's like if these elites are going to look down on me, then we're going to show them. And the thing is, you know, like I said, 63% of the American people don't have a bachelor's degree.
No.
And in a democracy, more is better than less. So
yes.
you know, Donald Trump was a case of democracy. You know, people with college educations who kind of feel that they should be running everything in this country suddenly weren't running the government, because you know, people without college degrees formed the base of the Donald Trump coalition.
Right. And Will Bunch, I'd be remiss if I didn't, as we're wrapping up, bring up that the United States is unique in the world, just as we are with medical care for its citizens and everything else, where the rest of the civilized world treats health care as a basic human right. You know, I think we're one of the few developed economies, leading economies, that has a for-profit healthcare system that regularly bankrupts people when they get sick. Same thing with our higher education. Most developed democracies, developed economies around the world have free or very affordable higher education, right? Again, yeah, we are we are the anomaly. We're not the rule. We're the exception.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I found researching this book is it even goes deeper than that, though. I mean, if in Europe, you know, and we all know Europe's not Nirvana, it has its issues. But like you said, there's much more of an opportunity to get a free or almost free college education in most European countries. But the flip side of that, though, is there's also more opportunities for people who don't go to traditional college. Mm. You know, there's more, you know, internship type, you know, arrangements where apprenticeships.
Right. Like work and training, apprenticeship programs.
And, you know, if you go that route and, you know, you're an apprentice and then you get a job at a factory, well, unlike in America, you know, you're getting 6 weeks of vacation, you're getting healthcare. And, in Germany, for example, the average worker has a much greater say in how the factory is operating. So, which contributes so much to people's personal satisfaction. And I think you just don't have this issue of respect, you know, which is really what drives the culture wars and makes people so tribal, you know, that, you know, your side looks down on my side, whether
yeah.
it's, you know, whether it's working class people feeling that college educated folks think that they're deplorable and are looking down their nose at them, you know, or, you know, the way the college educated people came to resent folks in the Trump era. You know, I mean, initially the attitude was kind of just to ignore the heartland, that it was, quote, flyover country, that, you know, we fly over these people. And then the people from flyover country won the election in 2016.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, these people are our enemy. You know, it's like, well, you know, why do they hate us? Well, it was just like 9/11. You know, 9/11 was like, why do they hate us?
And
it's
yeah.
like, Trump getting elected in 2016, why do they hate us? Well, this book tries to explain some of that. You know, because if we don't address this as a problem, you know, if college is the fault line in American politics, then fixing the problem has to start with college and higher education. And you know, again, what is college? How do we define higher education as something that goes beyond college, perhaps? And who pays for it? You know, we need to make different decisions about those things.
All those things. The book is After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. Will Bunch, always a pleasure, Will. Congratulations. I know you've got a month probably filled with similar interviews. So.
Well, I've got a day. I've got three more today, which is just insane. So, but I don't know. Everybody... everybody circled the day on the calendar for some reason. But I hope so. I mean, you know how it is when you're an author, you want to spread the word far and wide.
Most so, definitely.
I'm probably going to have total laryngitis at the end of this. Hopefully it'll be worth it.
It'll be worth it. But thank you for writing this. Thank you for shining a light on a really important subject.
Thank you for your interest in it, Nicole. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Always good to talk to you, Will. Thank you so much. Will Bunch. And with that, we come to the end of another program. Sorry about the sound quality. Try as I might, it could be good on this end and lousy on the other end, and I do what I can do. Tomorrow, Gotta Laugh is back. So fun and frivolity shall occur. At least that's the goal. All right. Thank you for listening, everybody. You have a great night. I'll see you tomorrow. And I'll leave you with the news, because we can. And with the rest of the details on the Inflation Reduction Act. Not infrastructure. Inflation. See you tomorrow. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Madam President, it's been a long, tough, and winding road. But at last, we have arrived. I know it's been a long day and a long night, but we've gotten it done. Today, after more than a year of hard work, the Senate is making history. I am confident the Inflation Reduction Act will endure as one of the defining legislative feats of the 21st century. To the tens of millions of young Americans who have spent years marching, rallying, demanding that Congress act on climate change, this bill is for you. The time has come to pass this historic bill.
Well, it was a long weekend for members of the U.S. Senate, but they worked around the clock, held a Votorama, and on Sunday afternoon passed a $750 billion bill encompassing health care, tax reform, and climate change. The Inflation Reduction Act passed through the Senate with Vice President Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote.
The question is on passage of H.R. 5376 as amended.
I ask for the yeas and nays.
Is there a sufficient second? There appears to be. The clerk will call the roll. The yeas are 50. The nays are 50. The Senate being equally divided, the Vice President votes in the affirmative, and the bill as amended is passed.
So it's a new week and perhaps a political reset for President Joe Biden, who's now out of COVID quarantine after more than 2 weeks of isolating at the White House. Today, he and First Lady Jill Biden plan to travel to Kentucky to visit communities hit by deadly floods. Tomorrow, he'll sign the CHIPS bill into law. But let's get back to yesterday's historic vote. The final party line vote was 51 to 50. But before the president can sign it into law, the House needs to pass it first. They're expected to take up the legislation on Friday, and with only a 3-vote buffer, Nancy Pelosi can't afford many defectors. So, what's in the bill? Let's start with climate change. More than $300 billion will be invested in energy and climate reform, making it the largest federal clean energy investment in U.S. history. It includes $60 billion for growing renewable energy infrastructure and manufacturing, like solar panels and wind turbines. It also includes several tax credits for individuals on things like electric vehicles and making homes more energy efficient. And according to the Democrats, this bill will lower greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by the end of the decade. On health reforms, the bill takes on making prescription drugs more affordable, but there are some limits. It does allow the federal health secretary to negotiate the prices of certain expensive drugs each year for Medicare. But the negotiations only take effect for 10 drugs covered by Medicare in 2026. That increases to 20 drugs in 2029. And unfortunately, Republicans blocked the provisions in the bill that would have capped the price of insulin, something incredibly expensive in the U.S., at $35 per month. Now, the Senate parliamentarian ruled that the cap could only apply on Medicare, not on private insurance. So Democrats attempted to split the measure, but Republicans blocked that measure, 57 to 43. They needed 60 votes to keep it in the bill. So when you have to pay more than $35 a month for your insulin through a private insurance plan, blame the Republican Party. It falls squarely on them. The bill does put a cap of $2,000 per year on out-of-pocket prescription drug costs for people on Medicare, effective in 2025. And it includes a three-year extension on health care subsidies in the Affordable Care Act, which originally passed in a pandemic relief bill last year. That will help millions of Americans avoid spikes in their health care costs. And finally, tax reform. This legislation creates a 15% minimum tax for corporations making $1 billion or more in income annually, bringing in more than $300 billion in revenue. But as we figured she would, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema agreed to sign on to the bill only if the provision that killed the carried interest tax loophole, something that benefits her largest private equity investors, was cut. But in its place, a 1% excise tax on stock buybacks was introduced that could bring in roughly five times as much revenue as the carried interest measure would have. But that won't take effect until next year. So expect big stock buybacks by some of these companies before 2023 rolls around. And now we wait for the House to reconvene on Friday and vote, and then it goes to the president. In other news, Indiana became the first state to pass a law banning abortion since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade. This law, which goes into effect September 15th, bars all abortions except in cases of rape or incest before 10 weeks and if the person's life is in danger. In response, pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly, one of the state's largest employers, said it would, quote, seek employment growth outside of Indiana. Here in Florida, Hillsborough County State Attorney Andrew Warren called his suspension from office a stolen election and a maneuver by, quote, Orwellian thought police. Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, suspended Warren for neglect of duty after Warren refused to enforce bans on abortion and transgender surgery. From the other Republican governor's behaving badly file, at least 60 migrants arrived in New York City over the weekend on buses sent by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. According to New York City Mayor Eric Adams, some of the migrants are being forced on buses from Texas. Abbott's office says migrants are volunteering to be bussed out of his state. A critic of the Biden administration's immigration policies, Abbott began sending hundreds of migrants on buses to Washington, D.C. earlier this year. More than 5,100 migrants have since arrived in D.C. from Texas on more than 135 buses. Now, many of them are headed to New York. Albuquerque police said they're looking for a car believed to be connected to four killings of Muslim men in New Mexico's largest city. Authorities urged the city's Muslim community to be on guard after a Muslim man was found dead on Saturday, the fourth to be killed in similar circumstances by the same person or persons since November of 2021. And in Uvalde, Texas, the school district is looking for a new interim police chief as Pete Arredondo awaits his termination hearing. Arredondo was placed on unpaid leave following his highly criticized handling of the shooting at Robb Elementary School on May 24th, where 19 children and two teachers were killed. Separately, the community school board president confirmed that the district has zeroed in on a property to replace Robb Elementary. The community superintendent reaffirmed that students will not return to the campus where the massacre took place because so many are still traumatized by the violence. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.